This is Xformation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Caden. And today we also have another one of our colleagues,
Lucas Heyo.
Frenchlier, Director of Experimental Economics Lab at Utah State University. Before we get into this, what do you think happened to time this year?
What did happen to time, Will? Does it feel off to you?
It
is there something going on?
Time is this wobbly construct to me. So I was recently reading about this Rolling Stone thing where apparently there was a study showing that performances of Bach are almost up 30% faster than they were 50 years ago, just by looking at the, you know, I believe it was Gramophone that was looking at a lot of this. They were just looking over time at the speed at which Bach was being played, and 30% faster.
It's not just people like me speeding up the tempo because he's just too slow.
Man, I'm not going to get into Bach is too slow. Maybe that is the issue. I don't know.
I mean, are the birds chirping their songs a little bit faster too? Is there any study there? Because they are pretty sound.
Apparently, so the birds apparently in the 1970s completely changed their songs. This is actually so in the 1970s, the songs that existed pre-1970s are completely different than the songs that exist now. It's this really interesting example of mimetics and meme culture.
Uh-huh.
But it happened with birds. Birds songs
meme first. Is that
birds
what you're saying?
First, no, their songs changed. There was like this changeover in how bird songs occurred in the 1970s,
and
we're only now just getting data of this because we're going back and listening to old recordings and finding bird recordings.
Well, I see a bird on Lucas's wall. I mean,
that's pretty good, right? That is pretty good.
That's
so Lucas.
That's pretty spot on.
Yeah.
Since you're here today, so tell us about this work. Tell us about the experimental lab. Why should we be looking towards experiments, and why should we be looking towards the experimental lab as this new source of information? What's the goal here? What's the benefit, actually, I would say?
Well, for the experimental economics lab, I think there's a few clear benefits. One is that we can run these kind of experiments relatively cheaply. So we can do a lot of policy experimentation in tightly controlled environments and test out things which maybe we wouldn't really have the opportunity to try out in the real world. And then also we have that tight control in the lab. So we're able to directly observe things and measure things which aren't really observable in the real world. So what is the effect on misinformation on quality of voting decisions? We can't really get at that in the real world because nobody even agrees what constitutes misinformation or what's sort of the right vote. So we're able to get nice, clean causal measures in tightly controlled environment where we're inducing partisanship. We're determining exactly what is the best policy for subjects to get an idea of how different things are going to work in the lab. And this goes well beyond just misinformation, which we're talking about now, but into all sorts of policy environments. So say in criminal justice, we can start observing things like, was somebody falsely convicted? Which in real world data, we don't really have access to that kind of information, or there's measurement error. So.
Yeah, no, and I was actually looking at doing some of this a couple of years back and to actually get data on, you know, I'm blanking right now on
trying to get
exactly
to jury trials and whether the jury
We were looking at pretrial risk assessment scores, and it was just really, really, really difficult to figure out data on individuals themselves and to track them over time. And so to actually understand that as far as what was occurring at the local level, one, all of our FOIA requests were basically denied. So we would have had to go on to something a little bit more high powered. But more importantly, there's this really, really difficult problem in figuring out how judges are actually using these pretrial risk assessment scores. That's a conversation for a different day.
Yeah, shout out to my former crim law professor who did a lot of good work on this, Claudia Jones. She used to go and talk to judges and say, hey, have you even looked into this background profile? Have you taken the time to review this case before just going straight to the trial and sitting on the bench and just saying, you look guilty? And it turned out, no. And so she's done a lot of good work to go in and say, hey, judges, maybe you should review this first. Just take an hour. Just look at it and then go make your decision, which seems common sense to us. But
for this project we're talking about today, you kind of hinted at it, this idea of misinformation. So where did this misinformation game and project come about? How, what was the impetus for studying this topic in particular?
I mean, sort of ripped from the headlines, if you will, right? So it's just been a really big topic over the last few years. And we have a lot of people in the literature doing work, which I think is interesting, but it'll be lots of, all right, here's some different headlines or here's some different articles. How good are you at spotting whether or not it's misinformation? Or, you know, who's more susceptible to misinformation? But but that's all well and good and interesting. But in terms of getting at, you know, what's the effect of misinformation on people's decisions and what types of content moderation policies, there wasn't much. And for that, we need to move into a more sort of, I'll say, a little more abstract world where we have, instead of it being a particular article or something like this, it's just realizations of a random variable. And our jumping off point was a great paper where they, by Cesar Martinelli at George Mason University, where he's basically looking at, you know, how much, to what extent will people buy costly information in a voting game? But he's looking at a place where there's no opportunity for communication. So we took that as one treatment, right? So that's the world without social media. And then we said, what happens if we add in social media but prevent misinformation? So anything that gets shared has to be truthful.
Yeah. Before we go too far, just what is a voting game? Because to me, that just seems kind of bizarre. Is there like a simple way to talk about a voting game?
So there's a lot of different types of voting games. The one we're looking at was they're voting for one of two options. We did an odd number of players so that, you know, a tie, we don't have to worry about ties. And then we just, before the game, the computer just decides which one of those options is quote unquote correct, which is to say which one will make everybody better off. So if the correct option is what wins the vote, then every voter gets a certain payment and they don't get that payment otherwise. And then in addition to that, we added in partisanship, which is to say, regardless of whether or not the vote was correct, people would get a certain payoff if the vote was for one option versus the other. And we could vary that across individuals. So we have this idea of induced partisan preferences, as well as this idea that everybody, in some sense, also wants to get the right policy. So that's the voting game we were looking at, just voting on one of two policies. And then they can buy information that will suggest which of the options is actually correct. It's not perfect. There's some noise in there. And the more information they buy, the better or more certain they are about which one's correct, which is the correct policy.
Okay, now I'm starting to understand. So it's all about getting access to information, but using something to purchase it with?
So you're using their own money to purchase it with, right? So the money in the game.
Money, yeah.
Ah.
And yeah. So this is the skin in the game.
So they've got skin in the game, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So any experimental economics fraud paper usually, I mean, there may be an exception here or there, but is almost always the amount of money they make from the experiment is determined by the decisions they make in the game. We want them to have actually have some bite that actually matter.
Yeah.
Now we're talking. Okay.
So then we add in this idea that in addition to being able to purchase information, they're able to share it via some sort of, you know, simulated social media platform where they can follow people in their group and then they each decide to make posts. As I mentioned, right, in one treatment, there's just no ability to post anything false. Now, there's still the ability to strategically withhold misinformation. And then we add in another treatment where they can post lies, where misinformation is present. And our whole goal here.
So just to review, there's three conditions here that you're really trying to test for, which is this world without any social sharing of information, right? Yep. Where there effectively is no Facebook or Twitter or whatever, what have you. Exactly. The second condition where you have this possibility of sharing information, but it has to be true. And then this third condition, which is this misinformation condition, which is, again, it's, you have the ability to share it over a social network. But it has the possibility of being false.
That's exactly right. So then notice what that does is allows us to causally and cleanly determine whether or not social media in the absence of misinformation is actually going to make us better off. And to say, well, all right, what happens once we allow misinformation? Is that still an improvement over no social media? Is it worse? And frankly, for that matter, is social media, even in the absence of misinformation, good for us? Because you could imagine a world where people strategically withhold information such that beliefs get skewed in a particular way, and the social media just ends up being a problem, right? Because it's not the case necessarily that even if we get rid of all misinformation on, say, Facebook, if we're still biasing the type of information that's there, even though it's all truthful, that still could end up being a bad thing.
Yeah. So what are the big results? I feel like
we need the big reveal here.
Yeah, the big punchline, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we can. It's pretty simple, actually. So one thing that surprised me was, one, once we add in social media, people actually purchase more information individually. So I would have expected before running the experiment that they would expect, oh, I'm going to get information from social media, so I'll lower the amount of information that I individually purchase. And we find the opposite. So maybe a bit of a public goods type story. People are, you know, supplying a public good in the form of that information. But so they become more informed, which increases the cost of information. And if there's no misinformation, we actually see a pretty big increase in the quality of group decision making, meaning just how often the group votes for the right policy.
Yeah.
So demonstrating that, you know, there are gains to be had from social media. But once we add in misinformation, that gets wiped out. People are still buying more information than if there was no social media. But the misinformation is actually degrading the quality of votes such that it's actually a bit worse than if there was no social media. And welfare, so accounting for the increased cost of information and so forth, also is worse off, right? So if we don't do something about misinformation, then we'd be better off not having social media, is in some sense the punchline of the paper so far. So where we're headed next is
That's a brutal. Yeah, that's something that you should let simmer for a little while, because that's kind of a brutal.
Let's just pause for emphasis.
Yeah, that to me is when you read this, it's that to me is the big kicker, right? That effectively, that in a world of misinformation, that there is still disinformation acquisition, right? People are still wanting to consume more information, which I think is actually really interesting as well. As kind of a, you know, you hint at this, but to me, this is also a really, really interesting thing that once you also have the presence of a platform or the presence of some sort of information sharing device, that people themselves, did you see bifurcations in that, or like the, you know, a skewing of this such that some people were wanting to consume more information than others, or was it everyone was starting to consume more information all at the same time? Because at least one of the things that I've always, everyone.
So we're skewing people by their, so the partisan preferences that I mentioned basically have people favoring one policy over the other, and it's just from a uniform distribution to keep things simple for subjects in the lab. And so, yeah, your extreme voters, meaning the ones with really extreme preferences, are less inclined or less interested in purchasing information. It's more your moderates who stand or strongly prefer getting the right policy who tend to be the ones buying more information.
Well, my favorite line out of the paper was that whenever you see people who are sharing misinformation, it's mainly just when it benefits them. They're just doing it because they think it benefits them. Is that right?
Exactly what we would expect, right? So
the devious ones, that's what I read it to be. And
although in
kind
some
of made me laugh.
We've induced to be there. So we weren't in some sense conditioning on their individual characteristics, but rather what we induced in the lab, the preferences that we induced.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So you created deviousness.
Or at least partisan.
Lab experiments, creating deviousness.
Perfect. Yeah. How well do you think that does translate into the real world as far as an application how people are using this in a voting, in a more like complicated voting setting.
I mean, external validity is always a concern, yeah. Right? So we have quite an abstract game. So it'd be quite a step for us to, in some sense, say, oh, this maps one-to-one into reality. So I view this as sort of like a first step where we can use the lab as kind of a testing ground for getting at questions we can't really address in the real world, and then we can start playing around with, say, content moderation policies. And this nonetheless, right? The, you know, the environment we've set up is real. The money that they're earning is real. I tend to think that it's something that applies reasonably well to the real world, but we need more data. We need more experiments and experimentation, maybe moving us closer and closer to real life. The biggest jump, I think, for me is moving from realizations of random variables to policies, like actual real world policies, whether it be on immigration or whatever. So I think there's probably quite a gap between these sort of artificial preferences over random variables and, you know, actual political beliefs and preferences.
Yeah, I mean, speaking on that, what do you think are the big takeaways, at least for people within the policy space, concerning this game in particular? I know that you, in the past, I mean, and one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this paper as well is that, you know, that there is, at least for the social media platforms, a clear, or at least an incentive for them not to be to engage in trampling down misinformation, right? That there is this value that the entire platform seems to gain when information is shared correctly, or there's a not misinformation that exists on those platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a couple of things first, right? So some people, I think, are probably arguing, look, we don't need content moderation. Social media, it'll sort of sort itself out in terms of misinformation. People can spot misinformation, and it's not likely to have nearly the biasing effect. Whereas other people are saying, you know, we need, let's say some sort of third party, or we need strong incentives or consequences for, you know, platforms for not purging misinformation. I think what we can say is, well, it's not the case that misinformation is not going to have sort of negative effects. It's not something that we can just leave on its own. But I think one of the biggest points of the paper, which was not originally what we sort of set out to study, because we were very focused on just what's the effect of misinformation on these group outcomes, but that as time over the course of the experiment, right, people were interacting in these groups over a number of periods, and groups are fixed, is that we saw the social network kind of decay when there's misinformation. So people were following fewer people over time. And I mean, that actually corresponds pretty closely to something that social media platforms care a lot about, user engagement, right? How many, how likely are you, you know, or how much do your users engage with the platform? Well, if there's misinformation, we're finding that you, rather than engaging, right, you stop engaging. And to the extent that corresponds to their bottom line, and I think that's a pretty close correspondence, then I would expect that they would have a strong incentive to themselves be trying to get rid of misinformation. And that speaks to policy debates going on right now, right? You have lots of politicians and others sort of accusing these platforms of, you are intentionally, you're spreading and promoting misinformation because it increases your...
You're making money off of it.
Yeah,
that's the argument.
Yeah, and it's true. So it's interesting, right? Because these platforms are using just simple algorithms to figure out, right, what shows up in your feed, what the algorithm predicts is going to be something you're going to engage with. And it does seem as if, misinformation is something that people tend to engage with. But so just because it's what you in the short term would engage with, right? Because these platforms are using training sets over historical data, right? All where the misinformation being present. But in an ideal world, right, what we don't have in that is the ideal world of what are you going to engage with once we've purged all the misinformation. And so our data suggests that if, you know, short term, yes, people might engage with misinformation, but long term, they have an interest in getting rid of it because they don't want the user engagement to decay over the long term. So the way I think of it is they have a long term interest in getting rid of misinformation, quite contrary to what they're being accused of by a lot of people, mostly for political theater purposes. Mm-hmm.
And that goes into some of the research that Will and I are doing, right? We're looking at user engagement if you employ dark patterns. And some of these studies indicate that if you do a dark pattern and it's overly aggressive, that the response from a user is sort of equally aggressive, right? And even just if you do like a baseline dark pattern, like say, are you sure you don't want savings of $1,000? Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the option you select. It sort of gets this response of a user saying, well, of course I want the $1,000. I'm not an idiot, but no, you're just selling me something that's fake. And now I'm not going to use your service anymore. Goodbye. Right. And so that's sort of the dark pattern literature, just looking at what a company's reputation is if they use a dark pattern. So this is equally as interesting in the misinformation context, because if you have Facebook just letting misinformation go rampant, all of a sudden the user experience just plummets.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other clear line for me, and I know we've talked about this, is this this change that happened with Google. Google Ads actually pretty dramatically changed in 2015. The amount of ad loads that occurred on mobile platforms. And one of the things that they found is that by upping the quality of these mobile ads and also decreasing the amount of total ads shown to an individual, that long term, they're actually going to do better because of the way that the individual interacted with these, you know, higher quality ads. But at the same time, there's like, so the point being that in the short term, yes, there may be a push for the company to increase ad load, right? To get as many ads served to a customer and potentially get as many, you know, hits at a at click-throughs as possible. But long term, that as you're interacting with this platform, this, you know, this ad connector, this part of the platform over time, that individuals will say like, hey, this is too much for me, and they'll slowly start pulling back their experience or their use of the technology. And that to me seems to be this really difficult thing that at least some of the experimental work that you're doing really, really can kind of help to suss out, which is, hey, we kind of do have a good snapshot, at least of this. We, in some cases, we got a pretty good snapshot of the static view of what's happening. But the more dynamic question and how individuals interact and how they perceive their own experiences online. I mean, I can't even explain how many people have left Facebook that I know personally. And, and it's shown in the numbers, right? Facebook's engagement numbers have not done so well in the last couple of years. And it shows that individuals are reacting to their perception that maybe this isn't the best, you know, the best experience for them anymore. So with that, I mean, you know, I kind of want to end on a somewhat positive note, hopefully. So where do you see this research going? Where do you see this kind of next stage of this project or more broadly with the experimental lab? Because I know there's a lot of other questions you're trying to ask.
Yeah. I mean, so having sort of established that, you know, misinformation is in fact a problem, but, you know, but there's gains from social media to be had if we can just get rid of misinformation. So the next natural question is, well, what content moderation policies are going to actually be effective? And so that the next project actually is looking at exactly that, just trying out a bunch of different content moderation policies in the same world, meaning in the same sort of environment. We're also looking at just measuring people's beliefs over misinformation in incentive compatible ways, and then getting at their willingness to pay for fact-checking services, right? So, you know, people frequently will say, you know, we don't like misinformation. There's lots of research into, you know, can they spot it or not? But are they willing to pay to get rid of it, and how much? And then how does that correlate with, you know, some observables, especially political affiliation is something we're interested in. And then right, what can we do about that? What leads people to have a higher willingness to pay? And ideally, we would like to see a market for this emerge, right? So where misinformation is sort of dealt with privately. And we sort of noticed in this first experiment, right, that you know, social media platforms have this incentive to do about it. Well, what's actually going to be effective for them to work on, what policies will work. And so that's where we are short term. Longer term for the lab itself, where we're focusing primarily on two research areas, mostly looking at misinformation, content moderation, you know, competition in the media between news organizations and what that does to beliefs of sort of voters. And then we're also looking at a lot of criminal justice issues. We've done some stuff on policing, prosecutors, mm-hmm. and plea bargains. We're looking at a few different papers on juries and what might bias jury decisions in depending on what direction you're looking at defining reasonable doubt, how variation in how reasonable doubt is defined across states affects people's reasonable doubt thresholds, right? Meaning what they believe constitutes reasonable doubt. And the great thing about experimental economics, it's a methodology, right? We're not really constrained in terms of topics. That's kind of what we're focusing on at the moment. But there's also a bunch of other kind of side projects built in there. And, you know, as other people come or want to research other areas, we're always happy to see if we can figure out a nice experiment to do it.
I think that is a lovely place to end.
Yeah, so the horizons are broad.
The horizons are broad. I find this space incredibly fascinating, and in many ways, you know, as you both have suggested, there's a lot to be done in this, right? There's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of low hanging fruit in so much of this space. We just don't really know what's going on. Well, until next time, this has been Xformation. I want to thank you both for having this conversation with us, and be well. We'll